Indeed. Indeed. 17 minutes before the hour, and we go to the phones. Okay. Hey, welcome to the program. Hey, Juanita.
I wanted to say something about fashion stores.
Yes, please. Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid.
I was very fortunate last night.
Cussing and a discussion with America's only born-bred Southern liberal talk host.
It was on
Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of the sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal.
And the thing is that
now from high in the hills of beautiful West Pinecroft, Virginia, here's on the Head On Radio Network.
Was about how much bigger.
Well, howdy!
Than what we're getting in the Gulf.
I've tried to point that out so many times.
And then another was about the.
But she was very sensitive about it, Juanita. She said not to compare suffering.
No.
But she said that has been going on for 50 days.
Broadcasting live from the Head On Radio Network sauna. I am Bob Kincaid. It is blistering hot in here. I mean, I've deliberately stayed out of the studio for as long as possible doing my research and so forth in other cooler portions of the house. It is brutal in here. It is Friday on the front porch on a beautiful, beautiful Friday afternoon in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. Enjoy yourselves out on the front porch. I'll just be back here trying to, make the best of all this and sweat off a few pounds. Whew! Where are those little birch things that I'm supposed to be, like, smacking myself with here in the sauna? I need one of those. Dang, it's hot. Yeah, the rerun stream's turned off. See, that's what the heat does to your mind. You forget little necessary things like turning off the rerun stream. No, it is Friday on the front porch, and we've got tons to get to this evening. First and foremost among those things, your calls, of course. But, you know, I was having an email exchange after the show last night about the persistent horrors of the business in the Gulf and the frustrations of watching politics and many other similar things. And those things are why, of late, I've tried to just sort of ease into, if you know what I mean, just sort of ease into the brutal business of the day with something a little bit lighter fare. You know, the content equivalent of starting off with a nice cool bowl of gazpacho before going into the, you know, roast beef, Yorkshire pudding, and mashed potatoes of liberal talk radio. Because it's just too hot for all of that. And with that in mind, a little something for you. Remember Jake Knotts? Jake Knottsy, Knottsi, pasty-faced, doughy white guy, looks like he's being choked to death by his shirt collar. He's a state senator from South Carolina, the one who said, "We already got a raghead in the White House. We don't need one in the governor's mansion here in South Carolina." Well, yeah, that the Jake Knottsy. Well, Jake Knottsy, or Knotts, has been censured by the Republican Party of South Carolina because they just want to move along from this embarrassing situation. Right? The Republican Party of Lexington County, South Carolina, voted 25-7 to condemn, censure, and ask for the resignation of Senator Jake Knotts. They did this with him in absentia, as they say. In other words, he was afraid to show his fat, pasty, doughy, white face. But the vote was 25-7. No, really. There were seven people who didn't feel like calling the party's gubernatorial nominee a raghead was worthy of censure. That's seven people I don't want to party with. They removed the wording, the Lexington, South Carolina, Republican Party. They removed the wording calling for him to be kicked out of the Lexington County GOP. We'll censure him, but we still want him part of the party. Don't want him running over and becoming a Democrat alone. Tommy Blanc from the land of names you could not get away with trying to make up. Tommy Blanc said, "I do not feel like we should be divisive and sow more discord by doing something so ugly as to censure him." By the way, WMBF News, whence came that story? In transcribing that quote, said that, "I do not feel like we should be divisive and sow more discord," yet WMBF recorded that as SEW, more discord. You know, it's terrible when you get a hole in your discord and you got to sew a patch onto it. Sewing the discord, if you know what I mean. Hey, right. But they had the vote, and 25-7 was the final tally. There were no electronic voting devices used in the process. Lexington County GOP Chairman Rich Bolin was rather concerned because he said that Jake Knopf's comments, quote, "lended credence to the idea that South Carolinians are redneck, backward Neanderthals, and we don't want that to be our image across the country." Image, mind you, not reality. Because that is the reality. South Carolinian Republicans are redneck, backward Neanderthals, with all due apologies to the Neanderthals in the crowd. Known some mighty fine Neanderthals. I had an anthropology professor once who said that if he put a Neanderthal in a three-piece suit, he wouldn't look any different than anybody else on the bus. But at any rate, even Representative Joe, whose real name is not Joe, but Addison, not really named Joe Wilson, Republican of South Carolina, the jackass who screamed, "You lie!" at President Obama. Well, he even condemned Senator Jake Nazi. So I was hurt and disgusted to hear Senator Jake Nazi direct such offensive slurs at a community which is very close to me. But you know what? Senator Jake Knotts ain't backing down. There ain't no back down in him. A lot of other stuff in that puzzle-gutted freak, but there ain't no back down. He's upset. He said the censure wasn't nothing but all politics. And he said libertarians has infiltrated the party. Said he hadn't called Nikki Haley to apologize. Given the sexual history released about Ms. Haley, she very well might have accepted it, the apology, by, I don't know, having a fling with. Well, then again, he's a pretty big old fella. He probably couldn't find that with both hands. Never mind. He said he hadn't called Nikki Haley to apologize. He said the press has given Nikki Haley a free ride. And a reporter, hearing those remarks, did ask Senator Nazi just what sort of free ride had the press given her. And Senator Jake Knotts responded, "Well, have you ever asked her if she believes in Jesus Christ as her Lord and Savior and that he died on the cross for her sins? Have you ever asked her that?" Now, I don't know it for sure. I mean, I know it's in the federal constitution that there shall be no religious test for office holding. Maybe in the South Carolina Constitution, you do have to profess Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior, and that he died on the cross for your sins. Maybe that's in the South Carolina Constitution, but I know it is specifically excluded from the federal one. But apparently, in that thing that is that apparently is sorely restricted from blood flow inside Jake Knotts' noggin, apparently. Well, that's the liberal media at work for Senator Jake Knotts. Because if you don't, I mean, she's already said she's a Christian. I mean, she won the Republican, Republican gubernatorial primary in South Carolina. You can't do that without flogging Jesus around a little bit. Yeah. But that's okay, because out of it all, Senator Jake Knotts, on this whole kerfuffle, says he could care less. He could care less about being censured by the Lexington County, South Carolina Republican Party. He could care less. Which brings us to that sort of lighthearted little cupcake segment of the program with which we will get things rolling. Because that phrase, and you know how it is with me and language. Language and me. You know how it is. That's the kind of stuff that's just like permanent fingernails across a chalkboard inside my brain. My children will say that every now and then. They'll say something to me, and they'll say, "Well, Dad, I could care less." And I correct them. I said, "Oh, so you care?" "Well, no, I don't." "Then why did you say you do?" I don't know where I could care less. I don't know how it got traction inside the American idiomatic lexicon, but it did. And it's worse than nuclear to me in terms of just the things it does to me. I hear it and just, I get a full body shiver. It's like smelling something rotten. You just recoil from it, or I do. And I was having, I hang on to things because, you know, they're going to come in handy somewhere down the road. I was having a Facebook conversation with John Fox's better half, significant other, partner in life, Gail, a couple of weeks back. And she brought up that phrase, and she sent me a clip from The Guardian in the UK. And I hung on to it because I knew it would come in handy someday, and lo and behold, it has. I offer to you, at this point, from The Guardian, David Mitchell's soapbox, "Dear America." He says this so much better than I ever could. So let's just get David Mitchell's take on this.
Dear Americans, as you know, everyone in Britain knows the Queen, and she's asked me to have a quick word with you on her behalf about her English. Don't worry, this isn't the standard tedious British sneering about lieutenants and aluminium. Essentially, her message is, use it how you like. She doesn't mind. She doesn't mind about the sensible ones, like spelling plough the way it quite obviously should be spelt, but nor does she mind about the silly ones, like saying tidbit, because you think the syllable tit is intrinsically rude. By all means, leave the U out of colour if it bothers you. I can quite see that the bit of a car you put stuff in looks more like a trunk than a boot, and that sidewalks are the bit at the side that you walk on. Fine, says the Queen. Help yourself. She couldn't care less. She couldn't care less, though. Not she could care less. That's the one thing she'd really like you to stop saying, because that, as an expression for not or hardly caring, just makes no sense. If you could care less about something, then all you're telling us is that you do care at least a little bit, because you could care less. But if you couldn't care less, look, observe this graph. Here's me on the scale of caring. I am at zero. Therefore, since negative caring is impossible, or rather is simply caring of another sort, love and hate being different sides of the same coin, etc., etc., I couldn't care less. I could care more, but I couldn't care less. If I could care less, I would have to care at least the smallest possible unit of caring in order to give myself room to care less. I can't care nothing if I could care less. But I might care much more than nothing. I could care anything from here to here. And I could still truthfully claim to be able to care less. I could care less is absolutely useless as an indicator of how much you care, because the only thing it rules out is that you don't care at all, which is exactly what you're trying to convey. So that's the one thing I really want... The Queen really wants you to stop saying. Although, while I've got you, the expression is, can you hold the fort? Not hold down the fort. If I ask you to hold the fort, the metaphor I'm employing is perfectly clear. You and I are in the fort together, holding out against the enemies of the fort who are besieging the fort. I now have to pop out of the fort for a bit to get some printer toner or take the cat to the vet. While I do this, don't worry about how I'll get past the besieging enemy. I have a secret tunnel and a false beard. While I do this, I want you to hold the fort so that when I come back, we'll both still have the fort. A perfectly reasonable metaphor embodying a sound military strategy. If I ask you to hold down the fort, what the hell am I talking about? Hold down the fort while I go out? Because, as you know, it's an inflatable hover fort. And once relieved of my weight, it might float off into the sky. Hold down the fort, and when I get back, the two of us can tickle the fort. No, meaningless. Stop it. But those are the only two things. Stop doing those, and you can say research and Bernard to your heart's content. Although, herbs. Really? You're French now, are you? With your herbal tea and your herbal remedies. Well, fine. Whatever makes you happy. I could care less.
Amen. And it has so much more cachet. Or, I don't know, is the British pronunciation cachet? If it's said by someone that sounds like the Geico Gecko. But really, can we work on that? I was so proud when I saw that little video clip that Gail sent me, because I felt a little less alone in the universe. Really, you're going to hear it somewhere along the way. Somebody's going to say, oh, I could care less about that. Can we make this a little personal crusade, please? Look at him and say, oh, really? So you care about it. And you will get this blank stare like a cow looking at a new gate when you do that. It's both educational and fun. Huh? Because it's one of those little linguistic viruses. It's a mistake we don't even know we're making. Then, frankly, I'm not all worked up about what the Queen thinks. But, obviously, by virtue of the fact that I do 3 hours of radio every night and have done it for several years now, language means something, even when I'm mangling it. But I'm proud to say, by the way, in the course of this segment, David in Tennessee is quite right. For those of you thinking you're being pretentious, no, goddammit, it is not claret, it is claret. It is a claret cup and a claret jug. And won't they be giving another of those away soon, here in a month or so, somewhere up in Scotland? Right, playing flog. Well, no, I play flog. The rest of the world plays golf. Because my attempt at golf is entirely backwards. But anyway. I've done many hours. Just look over at whiterosesociety.org. You'll see that there are many, 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 many hours of radio, as done by yours truly, many of which do have, in fact, several linguistic mistakes here and there. But I'm proud to say that there are things out there that I just won't do, mistakes I will not make on the fly, among which are I could care less, and something I heard while I was in Washington, D.C., I was fading off to sleep. You know how that is. You're in the bed. It's midnight or so. You've put in a long day's work. You're tired, and your head's beginning. And you do that little shake-wake-up thing because you're not quite completely gone. Yeah, what, huh? And the thing that was putting me to sleep was Anderson Cooper on CNN. And Anderson Cooper was reporting live from the Louisiana Gulf Coast, and apparently he had parachuted into New Orleans a day or so ahead of time. And there had been all kinds of background noise behind Anderson Cooper, which apparently bothered Anderson Cooper because he was bothered enough to mention them. And he said something along the lines of, I've been here for a couple of days now, and you may have gotten used to the sound of the railroad trains behind me and so forth. Well, I've got a very important interview coming up with Congressman Ed Markey. And you know, Anderson was full of righteous indignation, as we all are, about the Gulf disaster, the BP oil disaster. And, well, he was going to get, he was doing an interview about the high-definition footage that was finally released by BP, showing what was, oh my God, really going on down there. And he felt it necessary to warn his viewers, you've heard the railroad trains going back and forth and the noises of the railroad trains in the last couple of days. Well, in this interview with Congressman Markey, you're liable to hear some music playing in the background. It is, after all, New Orleans, and there's always some music going on in New Orleans. I'm told, and I swear to God, I'm not making this up. I promise you, I am not making this up. When I hear these little things by these multimillionaire professional broadcasters, I feel so much better about the effort that I make here and that all of us make on the horn. Because at that point in time, Anderson Cooper, professional multimillionaire so-called journalist on the TV box, said, never mind the music playing behind me. I'm told by a member of our staff that it's a calliope. And I don't know what the people on the other side of the walls from my room in the Omni Shoreham Hotel in D.C. must have thought. Because, you know, I was in my room by myself, I promise. But I sat bolt upright in bed and screamed at the top of my lungs, what? A calliope? Really, Anderson? A calliope? For how many million dollars a year? And you say calliope? How old is your staff? 12? Calliope. You know what a calliope sounds like. That's that thing that's driven by steam. It's a little piano-like organ contraption driven that's powered by steam, and they play it when the steamboats land there to unload the bales of cotton by the wharf and so forth. A calliope! Yeah. A calliope. As we say around here, I gotta get me one of them. One of them calliopes. Calliope! No! Calliope! And I realize I'm probably swallowing mountains and gagging on gnats. But honest to God, that's professional for-profit media journalism for you. A calliope. Where did he go to school? Anderson Cooper. No circus parade is quite complete without the hooting, tooting calliope coming down the street. Usually playing The Wreck of the Hesperus or The Race of the Robert E. Lee or something. I don't know. A calliope. A calliope. God, do I have anything here that features calliope music? Oh, please, please, God, if there is a God,
There it is. There it is. Tom Waits. Tom Waits, you little angel, you. That is apparently the sound of a calliope getting killed. Reverbo writing in, you want to know what I think? I couldn't care less about the damn calliope. And Jim's out there helping to solve the problem. Substitute, why not say I couldn't be bothered? And see, that's the point, Jim. We could say I couldn't be bothered. But because of the short-sighted American mindset, that would quickly be transformed into, I could be bothered. It is the fundamental inability to tell the difference between could and couldn't. Yeah, you know, it ain't just every day you get minor key calliopes on broadcast streams. Only on the horn. Only on the horn. I don't know. It just seemed like that would be a good place to start. A lighthearted place to start. A good place for me to sort of get into the swing of things here in the Head On Radio Network sauna. Why not, right? Yeah. So, in many ways, I guess that's about as much fun as I've got for tonight. But it is Friday on the front porch on the horn. Lots of stuff to get into. And we will get into all of them. It's about 27 minutes past the hour. You know the phone number, by the way, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, it's 304-658-3333. We'll take a little break and come back. Email rolls in, by the way, to Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. This sounds a little Friday on the front porchy. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to the horn. Yeah, henceforward and forever. This is the horn, by the way. I'm Bob at Front Friday on the front porch. Henceforth and forever, he shall be known to the horn as Anderson Calliope Cooper. Man, I love it. And coming up tonight on Calliope Coopy... See the problems that causes? Coming up later tonight on Calliope Cooper... Anderson Calliope Cooper. Calliope. Millions of dollars a year to say Calliope. I got to find more Calliope music. You know, just for the next time we need to talk about Anderson Calliope Cooper. Okay. Anybody out there got some good Calliope music, please? Okay. Let's go to the phone, see what's cooking on this Friday on the front porch. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, the best Calliope music on the planet is on the steamships on the river at French Quarter.
Absolutely. They play them when they come in, right?
And going out, and sometimes when they're sitting there, and yeah, it's wonderful. Calliope, huh?
Gotta love me some Calliope.
I'm on archives in the desert, so that bodes ill. But you know what?
The thing is, I fell asleep later, and I wonder what else I missed. I wondered if at some point he was going to say that he had walked over to the Café Du Monde and gotten him a big net.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
A beignet? Anderson Cooper saying the word... Yeah. Talking about the Calliope music in the background.
Oh, when he was in New Orleans?
Yeah.
Huh.
He said, please pardon the music in the background. Someone on my staff tells me it's a Calliope.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that might be preferred pronunciation in some places. I don't know.
Mars?
I don't know.
Lower East Side? I mean, what? Where? No, it's a Calliope.
I know that. Anyway, and I'm on the archives yesterday, I guess, I don't know, but I can get about an hour's worth of archives, and you mentioned English second language or English first language. You were talking about gerunds. What is a gerund? And I thought, oh, well, first the person who you're talking to would have to know how to spell it. Now, do you want that gerund in Hebrew or German or popular culture or...
Right, that's why I said I figured the answer I would get, do you know what a gerund is? Well, yeah, my granny turned into one, and that's why she's in the nursing home.
Now she's a dangling participle. With pronominal substitutions. Oh, God. Anyway.
Yeah, ain't nothing been right since she got bit by the mosquito and caught the subjunctive.
Yeah.
I got right under that subjunctive vein.
She was doing something verb-wise under the tree and dangling. Oh, God. Anyway, that's way, way off topic. I've been, you also mentioned the Art of War yesterday, and I thought, and I can't remember specifically what y'all were talking about, but it sent me to my copy of it, and I thought, I need something about the Art of War. When I talk, people kind of roll their eyes, and when I try to present how the dots are connected or what are the solutions or if there are any solutions or, you know, I mean, whenever I present a discussion or a debate or an argument, people, it just kind of like they look like they're ready to leave the room, and I couldn't get a grip on what that, because people are usually talking, they're speaking, and they're coming at the problem from the defensive, and I'm offensive, and, you know, going at something on the offense is more like, and that puts people off, or I don't present the argument in a very cogent manner, or whatever, or I get tired of arguing with a fool, and, you know, so anyway, thanks for bringing up the Art of War, because it clarified some things for me and how people respond to me, you know.
Yeah, right. But
anyway, well, and but you know, like they've burned our villages and killed our women and kids, and we're still fighting from a defensive posture. And so I don't have time to go. I'm on somebody else's cell phone minutes, and so I don't have time to get into deep philosophical discussions. So anyway, I just
no, but I understand. I understand the principle. But yes.
Okay, thank you. And the whole oil thing. Listen, we're calling it like the Iraq thing. The whole issue of what's happening on the Gulf Coast. Oh, I have some news, good and bad. My friend in Pascagoula, Ocean Springs, is starting to smell, get whiffs of the fumes, and she said they're not getting too much. They got a little bit in Long Beach, but not like they've gotten in Alabama and Florida. Something about the configuration of the bay there, I think. But she said it's just a matter of when. It's not if we're going to get it. So it's that's not good news. But my friend in New Orleans finally got partial duplex that they live upstairs. He and his brother live upstairs at his sister's duplex. It's all been trashed all this time, and he's finally got running water in the bathroom, and now they have a shower. That is absolutely the best news I've heard. God.
It's the little things in life that matter, isn't it?
Absolutely. But he's still having to take 3 buses to go to the emergency room in the ER lobby in the hospital downtown, uptown, so he can have wireless without having to go to the library on their hours. So he just goes in and air-conditioned buses and the hospital lounge, and he can sit there and work on his computer. And he's got to take 3 buses, but he still has to walk a mile to do the laundry and do grocery shopping. And so, he's got to. It's longer. It's far, there's still no grocery stores in Ninth Ward, so for him to go buy groceries for he and his brother, he has to walk way far away and then get buses and stuff. So I made up a box of non-perishables and staples and stuff and put them in the flat rate box and sent it to him. He said he felt like a 2-year-old at Christmas, opening up toothpaste and shaving cream and liquid Tide, and it was wonderful. So anyway, that's good news. Alan's finally got a bathroom, and that's he and Alvin have lived there for since the storm, and they've been taking a shower out on the fire escape with a hose, and there you go. So anyway, there's some good news coming out of the Gulf Coast. The only thing, when people are talking about the hand-wringing and the blaming and the screaming and the ranting and the raving and, oh, my God, about what's going on with the oil and BP and should we boycott BP and all, you know, I mean, chaos is always self-correcting. And I just have to kind of, I just looking at the civil and the social and economic and planetary mess that we've made, and chaos is correcting itself, and this is how it happens, and this is what we're paying for. And the more information I get about what's going on, I just, oh my God, I'm starting to glaze over by connecting the dots. It just seems, oh well, here we go again. Oh God, another Blackstone's taken over the management of the money, and they're, oh God, and Britain wants to pull out of Afghanistan, and well, yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah, that's one of those duh moments.
Yeah, so it's just...
I know you're short on time, but I have to throw something out for your consideration. You mentioned Afghanistan. Where I was staying in D.C., I had a couple of minutes to sneak out for a bite. And, you know, living on the cheap as I do, D.C. ain't a cheap place to eat. But I found that apparently Washington, D.C.'s, they call themselves the number one Afghan restaurant in Washington, D.C. I can't imagine there's more than maybe 2 or 3. But anyway, I wandered in there, and I, trying to get out for $5 or $6, I ordered this thing that, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was intriguing. Because it was their spécialité de la maison, And it was a classic Afghan, mind you, a classic Afghan dish made out of pumpkin.
Uh-huh.
And I sat there. It was delicious, by the way, and I did get out on the cheap. But I couldn't help thinking, really? How classic can this Afghan dish be, seeing as how they did not get the pumpkin any sooner than the year 1500 and probably more likely 1800 or 1900?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like Eurasia was just awash in squash, as it were, prior to the white folks coming in.
How long did you wait to use that?
I was proud of it as it came out of my mouth, Kate, because that one was on the fly, being awash in squash.
Okay.
But, you know, prior to the white folks coming and raping the Western Hemisphere in 1492, there weren't no pumpkins in Afghanistan.
Oh, well,
so
how do you know that?
How do I know that? Because we know that.
Oh, okay.
Squashes and pumpkins and so forth are native to the Western Hemisphere. They don't grow anywhere else. At least not before 1492. They grew up and down all over the Western Hemisphere, but not so much anywhere else, no. Or chili peppers. But that's a food porn discussion for when you've got time and you're not on somebody else's minutes.
Food porn for sure. The woman who lived upstairs from me at Highlander was from India, and we had interesting food. Oh my God! And that just that sort of ties into what my response to the chaos that's going on the planet is. The only response I have is, where's your water? Where's your food? Hug your loved ones at least 4 or 5 times a day. It's getting to be bigger and bigger and bigger, and the panic is starting to go in people's attitudes, and it's just like just stand one place, jumping up and down and screeching, and you know, and or the look on people's faces is just whatever. Or where I live, people don't even pay much attention to, well, I didn't know that. How do you know that? And oh God. So when we talk about Barbara Boxer's hair, that's an American. That's an American idol. That's reflection on the show. I just mean it's just like culture in general. That's just
and yeah, it is a reflection on the culture, and it's a reflection on the culture via Carly Cream of Wheat, you know, Farina.
Yeah,
her name's Farina. Farina is cream of wheat, right? Got it? Okay. It's a reflection on Carly Cream of Wheat, because that is how shallow she is.
Right, but she's not uncommon in the culture.
No, she is incredibly common.
Yeah, so anyway, I just... and that brings me around to... I needed to take issue with something that was said on Friday. Somebody was talking about the horn being a cooperative effort. I screamed out loud, "What?" And it the literal term. I mean, on one level, it's cooperative because we work together for a common purpose. But there's also a financial response. There's a responsibility. The implication is that we are responsible for, you know, we're jointly owned and operated, and the membership supports the effort and mutual benefit. It's an economic co-op, not just throwing ideas out. You know, that's just why they're still talking about money again. Go talk to somebody else. We're not going to have a co-op here pretty soon. You know, this is not like a Friday morning farmers market, or, you know, I mean, everybody brings something to the table, but we have an economic cooperative too, and it's getting skinnier and skinnier. I'm not even gonna ask. I don't even want to know. You get May done, and June is just half over, and we're just out of money. We're hurting, and pretty soon there won't be a horn.
It's been it got thin. It got thin around the second half of May, and has largely stayed thin since.
Well, we're you know, cooperative this. I mean, if we're so excited about being a cooperative, I suggest that some people send some money in because it's going to be.
You're suggesting we need more co-op in the cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
Or more operative in the co-op. I'm not sure which.
Yeah. If we're for the mutual benefit of the effort, then we need to have more money. And so I would like to challenge people to take a look at what their what frivolous money was spent in the last 2 weeks, and that could go to the horn, or what you're planning on frivolities for the next 2 weeks, send it to the horn, even if it's $5. It doesn't matter. Just send something. Cooperate. What'd you do in school today? I learned cooperation. Anyway, and what I say that chaos is correcting itself, this is part of what the, you know, chaos on the horn, maybe it's supposed to be correcting itself this way. I don't know. Maybe you're supposed to be off on the road doing great big things for other people and not us. That's another consideration, you know? I don't know.
Gosh, I sure hope not.
Well, me too. Because you don't travel very
well. I'm a good traveler.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah, I really am. It wasn't my fault that Delta screwed up my connection to Salt Lake City. And who knew you could catch emphysema from a Mormon? You know, in 8,000 feet altitude.
Yeah, I should have warned you about the altitude sickness. I mean, it usually takes me 4 days just to get used to Flagstaff, and it's only 7,000 feet. So, you know, I just forgot all about that. I just assumed you knew.
Well, I knew intellectually, but I didn't know it, you know, on the subdermal level, shall we say.
Yeah, you don't have any empirical knowledge.
Yeah, you know, I'd seen the episode of No Reservations with Tony Bourdain, where he goes to Cusco, Peru, and he's sitting there honking as hard as he can on an oxygen mask, and ha ha, look at Tony turning blue. But it didn't click for me. Hey, dumbass, you're at 8,000 feet. That's why the cigarette won't burn down. Get a clue, Moran.
You should try to cook cornbread at that level.
Oh my God! I bet it comes out tortillas. Now it all makes sense.
You have to add. I forget what you have to add.
A cup and a half of baking powder.
Yeah, right. Instead of bacon grease. Uh oh, we're bordering on food porn.
No, we're doing it again.
Anyway.
No, but what you say is true, Kate. It is. There is a cooperative effort of contribution of ideas and thoughts and so forth. And a lot of people cooperate in terms of or contribute to a cooperative experience in terms of helping keep the lights on. It's just the eternal struggle of building and maintaining and sustaining. And that's kind of where we live.
Yep.
But I live in a certain horror that one of these days what you have warned is going to come true.
And I'm out here on the desert, I will never know if we've gone under or not because the page won't load. So I don't know. Shit. All I have to do is just call the house, but oh, the phone got disconnected too. Oh well, shit.
Yeah, see, it all goes, when it goes away, it all goes away.
Yeah, it's all, we're all, see, that's my point. We're all interconnected and chaos is self-correcting. So if we don't want to pay for the correction in the way of dead silence and blank screens, then, we just got to get some more money coming at you. And, you know, bartering is wonderful because without barter, I'd be toast, you know. So, anyway, my truck had to be, I'm virtually homeless, and so whenever I have to do maintenance on my truck, it's like fixing the roof, or it's like doing the plumbing, or...
Oh, believe me, I speak that language, because... The rusty red pickup truck had to have a new rear universal joint as of last night.
You finally got a U joint. All right.
Oh, well, only one. You know, there's two.
I know. Oh, am.
But we're trying not to be too damned ambitious here.
Yeah, right. I don't want
get the one where the metal had already started shearing away from the cups.
Oh, that would be the one to fix. Yeah, that'd be the one to replace. Oh, damn. Okay. Well, anyway, I need to hang up here, and I don't know who used to say this. I'll leave you where I found you, and thanks for taking my call.
Oh, I wait all night for calls like these.
I know you do. Bye, hon.
Later. Bye now, Kate. See ya. Calling from the deep desert, that is our buddy Kate, and let's roll onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob, it's Cassie.
Well, hey, Cassie, you graduate, you?
Yes.
Congratulations, you high school matriculator.
I thought I'm a matriculatrix.
You are a matriculatrix, if I can say that word. It's much easier to type than say, I can assure you. Kind of like Anderson Cooper and Calliope's.
That's crazy. They don't... Okay, I know people can go into broadcasting without a whole lot of education, but if somebody told him what the music was behind him, how did they not also tell him how to say it?
No, see, that's because somebody held up a dry erase board or sent him a message on his BlackBerry so it was in text, and all he saw was Calliope, and that became a Calliope to him.
They should just write Moran on his whiteboard.
I have a feeling they did right after he said Calliope, Cassie.
You did. Okay, so I wanted to ask you something. I know you listened to Mike Malloy.
Yes.
Did you listen last night?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay. Well, have you heard the story about the 7-year-old boy in Afghanistan that was...
Yes, I have.
Executed for being a spy?
Right.
Is that something... Okay, so this boy is the grandson of one of the tribal leaders in one of the families there. And it was a different group that executed him. Right? They're saying that it probably had more to do with who his family is than with...
Yeah, because there are
actually being accused of a crime. Right.
Right. It is what we here in the hills referred, and remember, Afghans are Central Asia's answer to hillbillies. Okay, and I don't say that disparagingly.
It might have come before your kind of hillbillies.
Right. They got hillbilly vengeance down to a fine science. And that.
How do you put a 7-year-old in it?
Well, but it doesn't matter, because that's one of those ancient cultures where the sins of the fathers are visited upon the sons.
Even before the sons are old enough to...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Any idea?
Sure.
Okay, so if the United States was not in Afghanistan, if we did not invade after September 11th...
Right.
Would this still be going on? Like there are
sure
a lot of problems there that we've contributed to.
Oh, we've made it worse. We certainly provided the pretext just by being there. And alliances form and shift based on any given group's position relative to the United States occupation. And so if you've got a pre-existing grudge, or as we say here in the hills, feud, against another family group or clan, then having one get close enough to the United States to say that somebody, whether it's a 7-year-old or a pregnant mother or whomever, is a spy, well, that's just convenient. Sick, ain't it?
It's very sick. And... Can you tell me, why did we go into Afghanistan to begin with? I mean, I understand that is where Osama bin Laden train.
Because we were going to get him dead or alive. Because that's what we see right. down in Texas.
Then why didn't we just send in... Why did we invade? Why didn't we just send in tactical teams to take him out? I mean, why did we... And why are we still there? I don't understand this.
Well, don't feel alone in this or that somehow you're missing out on something that somebody else gets. You know, I was at the America's Future Now conference earlier this week, and there was an entire ballroom of people scratching their heads going, why are we still there? And it was a panel, the name of which was, I think, Afghanistan, Tactical Necessity or Horrible, Horrible, Terrible, Bad, Really Awful Mistake.
Well, I would say mistake.
Yeah, everybody in the room was coming down on the mistake side of the equation. It was a highly unbalanced equation.
Have we done any good in any of our... Has the United States done any good in any of our invasions anywhere ever in...
Well, it depends on who's answering that question. If you're an American oil company, we've done lots of good. If you are the grieving family of a dead soldier, marine, etc., then it becomes a much more fluid question. If you are a believer that you don't go and start wars in other people's countries just because you can, then it is a horrible existential challenge of a mistake.
So if it's an existential challenge of a mistake, then why isn't it being debated? Anywhere, I mean, we even talk about...
Well, because if you debate it, somebody else will say you don't love America.
I mean, I know that sounds simplistic, Cassie, but it's the honest truth. It's why things like this don't happen in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I see. You want to debate us being in Afghanistan. Okay, I understand.
You don't support the troops and you don't love America. Now, the next question in this debate is, why don't you support the troops, and why don't you love America? And the Democrats are absolutely no good whatsoever.
They're going to hang you.
The Democrats are no good at maneuvering into or out of that kind of a mess.
Okay, what are the Democrats good at?
Surrendering. Wow, that was quick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We are not good at standing up to Repiglicans. We are not good at explaining why our ideas are better than the other side's ideas. And in large part, you know, I said that too quickly, perhaps, Cassie, because it's not all Democrats.
But is it because we're not on enough radio stations and enough TV shows, or is it because we don't have the message right?
It's both. Let's put it this way, Cassie. Even if we got the message right, we would still have a problem because we would have very little means of disseminating that message. We could maybe get Rachel Maddow to talk about it, maybe get Keith Olbermann to talk about it. And, you know, maybe Malloy or me or Hartman or you know, some of the others.
Yeah.
But that's it. Meanwhile, for every hour of liberal talk out there, there are 1,000 hours of right-wing babble.
Is that statistic still valid?
It's probably more valid now than it was, because that statistic was created back when Air America was still a going concern.
And now, other than a couple of stations with Malloy, the only liberal talk anywhere is just internet-based, right?
Well, I mean, no, there are liberal talk stations. I mean, there's Green 960 in San Francisco, and there's the station in Portland, the station in Seattle. There's a station in Madison, Wisconsin. There's one in Minneapolis, Minnesota. There are a few here and there. There's a station that plays...
You have not mentioned New York and in Washington.
I know. Frustrating, isn't it?
Yes.
You can turn on, and I do it every time I'm there. I turn on the car radio as I'm driving in and driving out. and just run up and down the AM band trying to find a liberal radio station in D.C. And it is damnably difficult to do. Bear in mind, in a city that would vote for Daffy Duck before it would vote for a Republican for president. Yeah, that's the thing. Demographics have nothing to do with it. It's mostly right-wing radio is mostly driven by ideologues who own the airwaves. It would make good business sense to have, you know, and it does. I mean, look, Green 960 and those other stations I mentioned. What is it, KTLK in L.A.? They're not going under. They might be struggling. All radio stations struggle. It's a constant struggle to do radio. But they're there. But in a market like D.C. or, New, you know, there's one in Boston. I forget what that station is. Seems like it's somewhere on the 1500 band of the AM dial, maybe 1510 or something like that. But they're there, and you know there's just but the thing is, while there's a smattering here and there, there is an absolute the country is deluged with right wing babble. I mean, you can go through major metropolitan areas, Cassie, and you can find Rush Limbaugh on three different AM stations.
Do you know that on military bases, the radio networks, the radio stations that you get? It's all right wing. There's nothing left. And if you turn on a TV if you turn on the TV on a military base, you get Fox, but you don't get CNN or MSNBC or anything else. And some of the websites even are blocked by the military. Some of the, you know, progressive websites.
I'm not surprised. Because, you know, who runs the military? Right-wing ideologues.
That should concern us by itself.
Yes.
I mean, beyond.
But if you complain to the right-wing, I'll say, well, Armed Forces Radio has NPR. That's the same as having Rush. When it's not.
But it only has NPR for like an hour a day.
Right.
And it has Rush for like 10 hours a day.
I don't think it's
not the same at all.
They carry, Armed Forces Radio carries like 2 hours of Rush, don't they?
I think they carry it a couple of times a day, though.
Oh, geez. Worse than I thought. But yeah.
I think it's pretty bad.
It's part of. You said, is it one or the other? And actually, it's both. And like I was going to say, and I think I mentioned this last night, one of the frustrating things about being at America's Future Now was hearing this steady stream of brilliant analysis and thought and commentary that deserves to be debated in the so-called marketplace of ideas, but it won't be because there's nowhere to get the ideas out.
I have a question for you. When the Republicans had their conservative conference thing with Sarah Palin and all of that, it was on TV every night.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Sarah Palin's speech, and they had all kinds of stuff. I mean, that whole thing was her, you know, moving her leg and her things and her answers in her hand.
Right.
Right? That was all from a conservative. But that was on TV before. It was to make fun of her having answers in her hand. It was on TV just because.
Yeah, C-SPAN covered it, didn't they?
MSNBC had it on.
That's right, they did, didn't they?
They did, because I watched it, and they had Ed Schultz was talking about, I mean, you know, I remember that. Now, if they did that, how much mention on any station did your conference get? At any station that's not the Horn?
None. Well, I mean, any station that's not the Horn. Yeah, there were other people on Radio Row, without a doubt. But was local TV there? No. It's D.C. It's just another conference. It's just another convention in D.C. Although they did AFN.
But why didn't even MSNBC? I mean, like, Rachel Maddow didn't mention it. She went to the Gulf, and that's really important. And she showed pictures of the oil. And, you know, I'm glad she did that. But how come none of them mentioned it? I mean, if these ideas are so important.
And they are.
And we've got it really, and we've got articulate people talking about them. Why isn't it covered on the news? Do they?
Because our side is
press releases and all.
Our side is still figuring some of that out, Cassie.
Radio's like 100 years old. I mean, how long is it going to take us to figure this out?
Well, some people get it. I mean, that's why there's a radio row, okay? But secondarily speaking, you have to go back to the late 60s and early 70s to, and I think we've discussed this before. I think you've even read it, the Powell memo, written by Lewis Powell before he went on to the Supreme Court of the United States, describing point by point how to go about taking over the media in the United States on behalf of the right wing.
It was Karl Rove and the people before him.
No. This is a process that started the morning after Barry Goldwater got stomped by Lyndon Johnson in November 1964. And the right wing swore never again, and they swore we are going to shift the politics in this country hard to the right, and we don't care. They took a scorched earth approach. We don't care what it takes. We don't care how much money it costs. We're going to do it. And that was a generation ago. That was a generation ago. And they did it. And they followed that. And they followed that game plan meticulously, assiduously, and mercilessly. And they made it work for themselves. So we find ourselves now, you know, starting long about, you know, so you can say it kind of started with the, although there were other attempts, I think, of the IE America radio network, which went back to the late 90s.
That's the one that Mike talks about.
Mike was on it, yeah. Hartman was on it. Peter Werby was on it. A number of other people. And it folded. And then the effort got serious again with the advent of the Bush administration and the recognition that we had to have some means of counter-messaging. But the money is not there yet. The money is still not there, Cassie. The money will not. Shows no sign of being there. And most importantly, while some groups get it, most don't. For instance, this year at America's Future Now, they actually had live video streaming of the conference content, or so I was told. You know why they had that?
Yes, I saw that because I went to their website from your website one day when I clicked and I wanted to go into the chat room. But I couldn't get Java to load, and so I clicked on thinking that maybe I could get into something on their site. But I couldn't.
Okay, but you saw that they were streaming live video, right?
Yes. Because I could see the video, but I couldn't get into Java. I couldn't get into the chat room.
Okay, well, You know why that happened?
Because you did it last year?
No, I didn't do it last year, but because I've been going hammer and tongs saying we have got to be doing this. We have got to be doing this. We cannot rely on the for-profit over-the-air terrestrial broadcast media to do this, or cable even. We have got to do this ourselves. And at one point I even pitched the idea of the Horn doing that live streaming for them. And you know what? They didn't take us up on that, but they did decide it was a pretty damn good idea, and they did it. I don't think it would have happened had I not suggested it and pounded on it.
Congratulations.
Well, that's not me just, you know, patting myself on the back, but
it is. And you know, next is the state Democratic convention and there are Democratic meetings. There are meetings of progressive of different kinds, and you know, Democracy for America and all of these things. And we need to make sure that, that some of them get national coverage without actually doing something stupid like having people read off their hands. Although maybe, you know, maybe you do something stupid and then everybody notices that there really is a conference and that there really are, you know, 1,000 people there, and I don't know.
And see, that's one of the other problems we face, Cassie, is we're sane. Sanity does, you know, which draws more? Come on. Which draws more? An intelligent person speaking intelligently and cogently on a topic of intense national import, or a clown?
A clown.
Bingo.
A clown. I mean, because people want.
Who's got the
Stupid.
Yeah, who's got the bigger ratings? Rachel Maddow, who is Maddow. I screwed up. Rachel Maddow, who is probably the smartest television news commentator out there, or Glenn Beck, who is who describes himself as a rodeo clown.
In my house, or
no, no. It's the answer is Glenn Beck.
I'm sure. I'm sure it is, but not here.
Right. Because
I live with sane people.
You live with sane, intelligent people. But there are a lot of people who tune in to, because they want to hear what scary thing has been given birth inside the thin gray settlings between his ears that pass for Glenn Beck's brains. I got an example of it right here. He did some creative editing with commentary by Phaedra Ellis Lampkin, who is the head of Green for All. And he cut her tape in such a way that she said, when Glenn Beck started talking about me, someone said, are you angry? And what I said to him is, absolutely, we have a plot to take over this country. Absolutely, we do. It's not a hidden agenda. That's all he played. And that brain-dead audience at Fox went, oh, my God.
John Fox does that. I mean, John Fox has a thing of Bush talking about, you know, getting drunk and taking over the country. I mean, and he doesn't say every time he plays it.
Yeah, but we all know it's a joke.
Funny.
That's the difference. Everybody knows it's a joke. It's like the clip of John McCain saying we've got to deliver more hot water to more babies. It's a joke. And everybody knows it is. I mean, I remember going back to my days at CNN. Ronald Reagan was trying to do some sort of... George Bush was talking about how closely he had worked with Ronald Reagan, making him fit to be president and all. And he said, we've had some setbacks. We've had some setbacks. We've had some successes. And all I had to do, this was back when we cut audio on tape. There was no such thing as digital recording or anything. I just took the little razor blade and I had him say, we've had some setbacks and we've had some sex. It was just funny.
Right.
But it was never offered as reality. Just like that clip that John plays is not offered as reality. Glenn Beck offers this as reality. To prove that the evil progressives, let's see, what is it? I found this over at Crooks and Liars earlier today from Dave Nywert. Glenn Beck says progressives are planning a summer of rage filled with violence, death, and chaos. And he used the Phaedra Ellis Lampkin's quote as proof of what's coming.
That he edited.
Because the whole clip, you know, I read you what he put.
Why do people listen to the whole thing?
Well, they don't even know the whole thing exists. They're Glenn Beck's audience, Kathy.
Why do people listen? I mean, I don't understand. I understand people who would rather watch American Idol or rather watch, you know, The Vampire Diaries or whatever they want to watch, right? I understand all of that, people who want to see that instead of listening to politics, instead of listening to news.
Okay.
But I don't understand people who want to be willingly misinformed.
No, no, they're not. They're not. It's not like Glenn Beck said, well, that's a clip of a broader statement. Glenn Beck operates by Field's third law. Don't smarten up a chump. And his entire audience are comprised of nothing but chumps. Does that make any sense? I don't know how to put it better, but...
Yes, but it's frustrating.
Well, sure it is.
I mean, what do we do about it? How do we fix it?
Well, if you want my biased answer, the answer is that we fix it by making sure that programs like this one have a broader reach, and that Malloy is on more stations, and that Tom Hartman is on more stations. And that's a whole different nut to crack, as in terms of how do you get access to more stations. Well, you know, with those rich liberals the right wing's always talking about that don't really exist. You know, George Soros, who is out to ruin America, better get buying some stations. And, you know, they don't have to buy a station in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles or Chicago. Start buying little 5,000-watt AMs in Busted Knuckle, Montana. Buy an AM radio. Buy the least profitable AM radio station in Birmingham, Alabama. In Memphis, Tennessee. In Little Rock, Arkansas. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Buy those.
We should have bought it in Arkansas before this election last week.
Well, exactly. How much of a difference would that have made? To have had liberal talkers going at Blanche Lincoln hammer and tongs day in and day out. You think that could have made up 2%? Because that's all it needed was 2% plus one vote.
And did you hear that the White House made fun of the liberals and made fun of the labor movement for supporting someone?
Oh, they didn't just make... They didn't just make fun, Cassie. They openly ridiculed and mocked. Well, there's $10 million you flushed down the toilet in Arkansas. Because they were jealous. They wanted that $10 million for other reelection campaigns. And that comes from a very, very prideful place where the Democratic Party thinks that labor exists as a wholly owned subsidiary. And bless his heart, Leo Girard, the president of the steelworkers, appeared on Ed Schultz's TV program and said, "Our obligation is not to be the Democratic Party's ATM machine." We talked about this, Sandra and I, a little bit last night on the program, and the fact of the matter is the Democratic Party does think of labor that way. But when the Democratic Party wants somebody to go do phone banks... And to go put out yard signs and knock on doors, they go to labor. Well, what are they going to do now when they go to labor? And labor says, "Hey, do you remember what you said about us in Arkansas? Go pound sand. Ask Rahm Emanuel to go door to door." And it might not be a bad idea to do that.
Well, I bet Rahm Emanuel will hear from real people and, you know, see that there's another side to things. But how come on the right side, the right-wing crazy Christians, the ones all the way over on the other edge, how come they got 20 years to decide that the party had to be more right-wing and that the party needed Sarah Palin and that abortion needed to be on the agenda and all of the things that they decide? And those of us on the left are the party that's closest to us calls us the crazy left. I mean, why don't we have any of the same power?
Because, and this goes back to that old quip from Oh, there he was, and now he's gone. I do not belong to an organized political party. I am a Democrat.
Will Rogers.
Will Rogers. The Democratic Party is like herding cats. The Republican Party is like sending the Wehrmacht on a marching party. If the Republican Party tells its shock troops to go forth on issue A, they go forth on issue A and issue A alone. It's the difference between being an authoritarian-based party and a party based on individual liberties. It is much, much, much harder to organize inside liberal or progressive circles because, among other things, Cassie, we have not figured out the fundamental principle of unity of issues. Because a Republican knows that when they go out and they advocate for an elimination of the estate tax, that it will bear fruit in terms of their desire to undo abortion, undo Roe versus Wade, or Social Security, or whatever it is they're after. They understand that advocating right-wing issues is good for all right-wing issues. We on our side have not figured that out yet. We have not figured out that environmental issues are feminist issues.
And instead, we just fight with each other.
And we fight. No, we fight for our individual causes instead of fighting for a framework that will permit success for all of our causes. And then you get people like Bill Clinton creating the Democratic Leadership Council and the Rahm Emanuels of the world, who think that liberalism is passé. It was on Monday evening at AFN when Andy Stern, who used to run the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, delivered a very condescending lecture saying that we now are as far from Roosevelt's New Deal as Roosevelt's New Deal was from the Civil War, and that we have to forget about New Deal principles and go forward with the situation as it is because we are now a service economy and we can't get all wrapped up in wanting to make things anymore.
It was
snarky and miserable.
The country, that would be fine. But how is a service economy going to support the country?
That's the problem. It can't.
Right?
It can't. If you don't have stuff to sell, you can't get money in the transaction. And we can't just all sit around in a closed loop swapping Beanie Babies or baseball cards. It doesn't work.
I like Beanie Babies.
That's why I said Beanie Babies are baseball cards, but you can't build an economy around them.
No.
And so, you know, that's the thing. I get
you can build a stupid Glenn Beck economy around them. I mean, when I was little, when the Beanie Babies first were coming out, people would get them, and, you know, adults would get them and keep them on shelves and boxes and, you know.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, it was the modern equivalent of the Dutch tulip economy. You had people out there trying to sell rare Beanie Babies for $5,000.
We went to this lady's house when I was 5 years old, and she wouldn't let me touch any of them. And it was like, I mean, I remember thinking then, aren't those for kids? Like, I'm not gonna chew it, I'm not gonna break it. Aren't, you know. And she had all of these ones that were, she had to keep the tags on and she had to keep them perfect. And
yeah, don't tear the tags off.
That's a stupid economy. That's not a real economy.
And you know, the fact of the matter is, if we don't work on getting some sort of a manufacturing base back, we're going to be left at just taking in each other's wash. And that's not an economy. and we can't take in China's laundry.
Well, I think what the right wing wants us to do is to make things in other places, but not pay for them and then pretend they're ours.
You're going to have to flesh that one out a little bit.
Okay, like, you remember the whole thing about the Marianas Islands?
Yes.
Right, where they could put Made in America?
Right.
But it wasn't made by Americans. And
it was sweatshop labor, there was forced prostitution, right.
Right, and the owners of the factories didn't pay, you know, they paid very little for their labor, but they pretended everything belonged to Americans when they sold it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way.
And see, all of this free trade crap.
That's how the right wing wants to do it. How can somebody who's
but wait, Cassie,
not know that what the other side is?
Cassie, you're making a small mistake, dear. It's not just the right wing that wants to do it that way. Globalization and free trade is an infection that courses through the bloodstream of a whole bunch of the Democratic Party too. They really, really believe this economic myth, and it is a myth. It has, you know, a legend. A legend is a tale that has some basis in fact, whereas a myth is wholly made up.
Yeah.
This is an economic myth. Globalization is an economic myth. Free trade is an economic myth.
But if you take the concepts that are behind globalization and the way that they talk about it is like it would work for these kinds of people for this length of time, probably, right? I mean, like it could be okay for these people. As soon as you start looking at it globally and you start looking at, okay, well, what about people on the other side of the globe? What about the people who are working? What about the people who are buying it? What about and start looking at the bigger picture. How is it not completely obvious that it falls apart? I mean, it's like saying, you know, that everyone can drive a new car. Right? Well, okay, so maybe in this town, everyone of this income level can drive a new car this year. Right? That's probably true. But if you took that and you then said, well, that means that everyone in the whole world can drive a new car this year, that's crazy. Because it falls apart as soon as you make it bigger. And doesn't this...
You're talking about issues of sustainability.
Yes. Doesn't globalization fall apart as soon as you make it longer than a year and you make it tighter than just the people who own the factory? Doesn't it all fall apart, like, almost immediately? Or am I just jumping the gun?
No, I don't think you are. I don't think you are at all. But if you heard people like... Clyde Prestowitz and Scott Paul talking a couple of days ago, you know that the idea of even having something called an industrial policy in the Obama administration is treated as some sort of sick heresy. Because, you know, we're so far past that. That's not the kind of America that we have anymore.
Stock policy.
Sure we do.
So why is having an industrial policy or having a labor policy so crazy?
Well, because Cassie, making things is so dirty and degrading and, well, it's so recherché. If that's the right word I'm looking for, I'm just trying to sound snooty, that's all. They really, really do look down their nose on the idea of America making stuff and selling stuff. Because we would far rather just peddle phony baloney things like credit default swaps and derivatives. We'd rather peddle those to the rest of the world.
But didn't that all come crashing down a year ago, and haven't we learned anything?
No, we didn't learn anything. What we learned is that we got to come up with another con.
You know this makes me hate people, right?
Sorry. Better to learn it now than have somebody hit you in the face with it like a dead mackerel a couple of years from now. Because see, I would just about warrant, Cassie, that when you run off to college, you're going to sooner or later take econ. You're going to take macro and micro econ. And somewhere along the way, because it wouldn't be any fun to go to an Ivy League school and not take those things. Sooner or later, somebody's going to start talking this globalization free trade BS to you. And I would far rather you at least have a little bit of an undergirding now, so that you know that you can, so that you'll feel comfortable looking at them and saying, you know, Dr. for brains, you're wrong. America has to be able to make stuff. It is a national security issue that we be able to make stuff.
Yeah, we don't make any of our guns.
Oh, we make some of them.
We don't make, do you know the uniforms in the military? We don't even make the uniform.
Oh, God, where do they come from?
They're coming from China.
Of course they are. I'm not saying that sarcastically to doubt you. I believe it.
Do laundry? No, when I used to do laundry, and I'd wash, you know, my brother's pants, or I'd wash his shirts or whatever, and I'd be folding them. Some of them are made in China, and this is his military issue stuff. This is the, you know, the stuff he wears on base.
Well, it's always if I recall correctly, your brother entered the military. Late Clinton administration? Early Bush?
No, Bush. During Bush.
Yeah. Well, remember what Bush's job was in, like, say, about 1975? You know, Daddy Bush. Daddy Bush.
Oh. Daddy Bush in 1975. I have no idea.
Ambassador to China. And Daddy Bush had a brother, a big brother, by the name of Prescott, named after their daddy. And Prescott became the president of the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce. And the Bush family...
Where you got lots of people to sew uniforms for 8 cents a piece that Army Reservists...
Well, but not just that, but, you know, it was Daddy Bush who started the business of pushing China for most favored nation trading status. And these things have consequences. The Bush family, for instance, either Neil or Lamar or Louie or whoever that other loser Bush is, that's W's brother, but Leon, not Jeb, there's another one. Marvin. One of those not Jeb, not W. Bushes has a cozy relationship with the son of the former premier of China, where they hustle some sort of dodgy goods that come out of the People's Republic.
Do you know that the standardized tests that we take in high school, do you know who publishes all of them?
I sure do.
It's one of the Bushes.
Yeah.
And they sell all of the teaching guides and all of the practice sheets and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it's a beautiful hustle. It really is. It's a con game of magnificent, exquisite reach.
And do they, I bet you they own the charter schools that are supposed to replace them too.
I wouldn't be surprised if they don't have a chunk of it, because you see, you got to remember, Cassie, the Bush family has never worked an honest day in its life. Starting with some Bush way back in the First World War who got himself put on the War Materiels Board, they have been at the public trough trying to get their back trotters in with the front trotters for three or four generations now, and they don't work. They don't produce anything. They don't make anything. They don't do anything. They are simply welfare queens who sup at the public trough and get rich that way.
Right, but they're going to criticize instead the people who are on food stamps.
Sure, because that keeps, you know, any good magician knows to keep the hand keep the audience's focus on the hand that's not doing the work. And, you know, that goes back to what you were saying earlier about people wanting to be deluded. You know, if you go to a magic show, there are people who watch the magician work and find themselves having a quarter pulled out of their ear that they're quite certain wasn't in their ear, but they look, damn, that's magic. And then there's the rest of us who go, how'd you do that? Because that didn't really happen.
Right.
Well, the Fox audience is happy to think that there are quarters coming out their ears.
And Jesus put it there.
And Jesus put it there. Ah, Cassie. You know.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you one more question about China.
Sure.
Is China communist or authoritarian?
They are authoritarian approaching fascist. There's not much communism left in China. In fact, it was several months ago. There is one Maoist village remaining in China. One.
And China's like two or three times the size of the United States.
They measure their population. No, the American population is a rounding error to them. The China's population is in the billions.
And they have one village. So it's more fascist.
I'd say yes. Because with this latest wave, what they've decided they want to do is they want to marry industrial production to the powers of the state, and that is the textbook definition of fascism.
Didn't the United States during World War II say we were anti-fascist, and then after that we said we were anti-communist?
Yeah, the people we were fighting were fascist.
But now we just exploit the Chinese no matter what they are?
Well, it's a sort of symbiotic relationship. We exploit them, they exploit us. I mean, our dollar, based on what I heard in D.C., our dollar's overvalued, and they manipulate their currency to keep everything in a sort of stasis so that they can maintain the trade relationship to their advantage. We are, in short, being fattened up for the day that they decide to slaughter us like a hog in the fall.
That's not going to be good.
No, it's not going to be fun when they decide to cash in. No.
It's going to be a lot more than a couple of poisonous toys at Walmart.
It's going to be everything. You know, the fact of the matter is, if they ever call the note, so to speak, if they ever start demanding that we pay up for all of the hot checks that George W. Bush wrote on them, and that we continue to write on them, we're screwed. I mean, we're screwed in ways that we can't contemplate screwed. We're so screwed that the light from screwed is going to be a million light years getting to us.
So, okay, if that's all true, then are the Republicans right when they talk about that we should be worried about deficits?
No. Over time, you have to worry about deficits. But right now, you don't. Right now, you don't worry about them because
recession and unemployment.
Right, because you'll re-cripple us. And I can't imagine that Barack Obama doesn't understand this, but apparently he doesn't. The reason all of these people are beating the tin drum for him to sweat the deficit is so that we can re-crash the economy so that in 2012 the Republicans can say, look, he crashed the economy. And he'll be sputtering on the hustings saying, but it was complicated, and they told us to do it. And they'll just say, nope, the brown-skinned man hates America, the Muslim hates America, the Kenyan Muslim without no American birth certificate hates America, and that's why he crashed the economy, and we got to have Sarah Palin, or Jeb Bush, more likely.
Sarah Palin's the biggest moron.
Oh, yes, she's not the biggest moron. The biggest morons are the people who listen to her and think that she's doing anything besides working a hustle while she's still in the middle of her 15 minutes of fame.
You know what's gross? The number of kids, the guys my age, who think she's hot.
Ew.
Yes.
Ew.
Yes. Yeah,
that's just icky. I mean, that's...
One of her kids is older than us.
No, that takes me back to, you know, the Casey's mom.
Casey?
Well, wasn't that Casey's...
Casey, I know?
No. Casey's mom... No, who is it? Somebody's mom has got it going on. That song from a few years back.
Okay. I don't know.
Okay, you don't remember it. All right.
I thought you were talking about the Casey.
No. I'm talking. No, it was a gross little song about a little adolescent boy having a crush on his classmate's mother. Ugh.
Yeah. All right.
Well, wow. And by the way,
I've been on the phone forever.
Yeah, you have. But you know what? You've made the best of it, Cassie. And, I can give you this much time in lieu of a graduation present.
Thank you. Does that mean you're not sending me a hat and gloves?
Well, no.
Promise me a hat and gloves.
I promised you a hat.
I applied to the Northeast.
I promise. No, that was, but I didn't promise you that as a graduation present.
Oh.
That's when you go. No, you get the hat and gloves.
Okay. I don't want to give up the hat and gloves.
No, you still get the hat and gloves.
I'll give you your hour back.
You just have to tell, you know, are you going to trust me on the hat and gloves, or do you want to tell me what you want?
Oh, have Agnes pick up.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll let her pick.
Okay.
We'll make it a committee of the girls in the family.
Okay.
All right. Cassie, take care, dear. Have a wonderful weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You too.
Oh, let's see. About 17 minutes still. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. This is Grant from Portland.
Well, hey, Grant. How are you?
Pretty good. I really enjoyed those last two calls.
Well, thank you.
I think Cassie's, we're all very proud of her. And we see great things for her future. She's got a nice sharp eye and a sharp mind. This is great.
Yeah, and a sharp wit.
And a sharp wit. Yeah. Was it Katie the call before, I think it was, from Arizona?
Kate, yeah.
Kate, yeah. I wanted to shout a book title out that I think she might find interesting.
Okay.
Okay. It's called The Globalization from Below by Richard C. Williams. And the ISBN is 978-0-7546-7038-4.
Lucky for her, she'll be listening on the archive so she can back it up and get all of that. Yes.
There you go. Yeah. It's a great book, and I understand she's doing barter. We're trying to do something similar here out of necessity. And this book is really good because this is a PhD that went through even the history of cooperatives and all these different things. And near the end of the book, he distills the 10 reasons why they succeed and the 10 reasons why they fail, summarizing his entire book and survey. And I think anybody who's into cooperatives, co-ops, barter, any of this stuff should really take a look at this work and look at that book. I think it's just, I wanted to put that out there as a resource for people to go at. I mean, there's no substitute. You can't substitute structure necessarily for just getting out and doing the work. However, you can always make it better. And this is the kind of book that can help guide people while they're running a co-op or they're involved in a co-op to really get it right and avoid the potholes they may not even know the name of yet. So I wanted to put that out there.
Okay, cool. Cool. Are you having success in your efforts, Grant?
It's slow. Trying to get the software together because we want to put the best technology we can together, but it's somewhat problematic at that level. But the thing that is encouraging is that pretty much anybody you swing a cat hit is into the idea, at least here locally. You know, I think the mood everywhere is that we have all just basically had it to the back teeth with this whole casino finance, free trade, crack pipe, delusions, you know, all this stuff. And I think we're all just ready to go a completely different direction. It's not the old left, definitely not the old right. It's something free enterprise, but we're looking at it with a safety net, is the whole idea. And I think a lot of people are enthusiastic about going that direction. And so we've had some success at least getting some of the best ideas together. When it's amazing, I think I might have mentioned this before, Les Leopold came through town on a tour. And one of the things I think that is important that he said was that, you know, if progressives don't get a concise, understandable, economic, fiscal, and monetary narrative together, what's going to fill the void is more of the same, the casino finance. We have to get that narrative in one spot, understandable. It can't be assailed. The other side can't redefine it. Those are the kinds of things we need to, as an effort, to be looking for. And I'm hoping that the research that I do and the things that I learn along the way are going to help complement that narrative. You know, and it may be one side of the country comes up with their own, and the other side is working on the same project in parallel. I don't know. There doesn't seem to be a center to this. Not that I could discern. Just a lot of cats running in different directions.
And that's the, yeah, that's the frustrating part of it, is the cats going in different directions part.
Kind of, yeah. I have to confess, in your earlier statement, the very fact that you have to lobby a group to do streaming raises some serious questions about the leadership of that group, I have to say.
But to their credit, that's not the whole idea. We're a little spoiled, Grant. Let's come at it from this angle, because I don't want to be damning or damning with faint praise.
All right.
We're a little spoiled. As liberals and progressives who want to listen to liberal and progressive media, we know we have to go onto the Internet, and we know we have to go find streams for it and podcasts and so forth, because we have learned this by dint of necessity. You know, necessity is a mother. And so we're used to going out and looking and finding and searching. So consequently, this is a format, this is a paradigm that we're comfortable working in. DC is not comfortable working in that format or within that paradigm. DC works within the paradigm of going on CNN or, you know, whatever, and talking to the Washington Post and thinking that when they do that, they get their message out. That is why, in part, Grant, that is why we're trying to make up a 30, 40-year gap in radio. That's why Bill Clinton didn't think anything of signing the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and making it easier for foreigners and various and sundry right-wing the corporate mobs to own the public airwaves. Because, you know, they really don't matter. Except the only problem is they do. And so...
And my earlier statement, then. Serious questions about the leadership. Any group that purports to want to lead or craft very important solutions cannot stay that out of touch. They really can't afford those kinds of mistakes. And they have.
And I don't know if I know the right way of saying this, but I'm going to try, Grant.
Go for it.
To them, it's not a mistake. Do you remember Howard Dean's 50-state strategy?
Yep.
Where he said, we're going to put Democratic operatives in all 50 states, no matter how red they appear to be, and we're going to work on our message in 50 doggone states. We're just going to be there. We can't afford not to. Remember all that?
Yes, I do.
Do you remember who fought him tooth and toenail over that idea?
I do not.
He is the President of the United States Chief of Staff now. His name is Rahm Emanuel.
Biting tongue. Yeah.
Rahm Emanuel wanted nothing to do with trying to support liberals in so-called red states. He didn't think they were worth his time or his effort.
Yep.
You know, screw them. If they wanted his attention, they'd build a bigger organization that would get his attention.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. I mean, to me, Rahm Emanuel is the epitome of that saboteur aspect in the DLC. Their only job is to keep other progressive agendas from coming to the top, and when they're ordered to, take a dive under the bus and let the Republicans take over. And I'm so tired of seeing this formula play out. It's why we're not getting anywhere, because of those guys.
Yeah, well, look, you know, it was, I have no doubt that, although this is speculation, I have no doubt that the sleazy, snarky comment about Labor's attempt to unseat Blanche Lincoln came right out of Rahm Emanuel's office.
What the hell is he doing in the Democratic Party?
What the hell is he doing in the United States?
Working.
I mean, he's got dual citizenship. He served in the IDF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know his beef.
I'm sorry, and look, it's not about being dual American-Israeli citizenship, it's dual any citizenship. I think if you want to serve that high in the government of the United States, you should renounce any other foreign citizenship. Whether it's dual American-German, or American-Lithuanian, or American-Chinese, or American-Australian. We can't afford to have people in our government who have divided loyalties.
I agree.
And what's more, you know, he's got divided loyalties as far as his own party's concerned, because he doesn't like Howard Dean. And he doesn't like Labor unless they're out there doing his bidding. You know, interestingly enough, the one Labor leader that the White House liked, Grant, was Andy Stern of SEIU. And he's the guy who delivered the condescending lecture Monday night at AFN telling Labor to get over it and deal with the service economy.
Yeah, can't imagine why Labor is getting its ass handed to it regularly. I mean, with leadership like that, how are you supposed to fight back? I mean, we had a conversation, you and I. I love Labor. I love union, the idea of it, the goals of it, all that. But there's some serious problems at the top sometimes, and it can't be ignored. I'm putting it out there. Like, man, when it comes time to get something into gear, and I know there's, I'm not talking about everyone, but when it comes time to get something into gear, there's this weird, inscrutable stall out that happens somewhere. And if this is the kind of leadership in some of the unions, I can fully understand now why. I'm not an expert in the field, all right, but I know what I see. If you want to flame me, go for it.
No. I haven't heard anything I disagree with. But you can't say Labor as in some sort of monolith, because that's why it's important that the following morning, Tuesday morning at AFN, Leo Girard took the podium and, without naming names, absolutely blistered the hide off of Andy Stern.
Uh-huh.
And why he showed up on a talk program earlier today and said, in no uncertain terms, our obligation is not to be the Democratic Party's ATM machine.
Absolutely appropriate. Yeah, I do apologize for going too broad with the brush there. Absolutely correct. I did not hear his comment. I've been busy with other stuff. But spot on. I think that's absolutely right.
And, you know, maybe, you know, meanwhile, and you talk about, you question the leadership of somebody who doesn't get the idea of leveraging internet media, that question of Labor fighting back? With all due respect, I had a brief break during AFN, and I just walked away to get a drink of water and just stretch my legs a little bit. And I walked into the exhibit hall, and I found one union out there. I think it was the NEA, the National Education Association.
Yeah.
And they're not really a union. But what was sitting on their tables? Rulers and notepads. In the digital information age, they had rulers and notepads and printed pencils, Grant. And that's something that labor does have to learn how to get past. The age of politicking with funeral home fans, emery boards, and packages of sunflower seeds is over. And that's all that can really be said.
I agree.
I mean, do you realize what I'm trying to get at? Because I stood there. I stopped dead in my tracks, Grant, and just stared at those rulers and pencils and notebooks. And I thought, dear God, that's how the NEA is reaching out to the progressive community. How much money do they spend having the rulers and the notebooks, the little vinyl notebooks with their NEA logo printed on them? How much did they spend on those?
Hermetically sealed since the 70s, it sounds like.
That, yes. It's not every day we get hermetically used on the program. Congratulations.
Hey, do I get a gold star?
You get a toaster.
Cool. A toaster.
But you... I see emery boards and I lose my mind. Because I've just got some vision of some you know, hard-working union member out there doing his nails. You know, after a hard day working the press. I got a hangnail over here. And it makes me a little crazy. You know, I'm really, really proud that the Campaign for America's Future did the streaming video. And maybe I'm taking too much credit. But I was I started talking about it literally a year ago. At the end of the last one, I said, we want to be here next year, and we want to do the streaming video of, you know, not just of, and, you know, we did do streaming video of me and my funny little balding head sitting there talking during the second day. But I wanted to do streaming video inside each one of the conference rooms.
Absolutely.
Because it's a necessity. If the organizations are going to spend all this money to bring all these brilliant people together to share all these brilliant ideas, for the love of Christ, make that stuff available live and on demand for people who can't get there.
Amen. Absolutely.
You know, if I hadn't been sponsored to go there, I wouldn't have been there, and I wouldn't have gotten the brilliant education that I got. And the things that I heard will stick with me. I mean, I learned a ton. And the rest of the country needs that ton of information. Because anybody who listened to what we were doing, the people I was talking to were not speaking Greek. They were not speaking in you know, linear A. It was plain, easy to comprehend, engaging English. You know, I had notes from people who said, you know, Bob, I hung on every word. Because this is information that isn't regularly available out there, Grant.
I agree. I learned something. I mean, did you like that little trick with the 40% overvalue on the dollar?
That just blew my doors off.
Yeah. It's nice when class opens up. Huh? You learn something. I dig it. I was glued, you know, to the interview.
You know, I was just sitting there thinking to myself, oh, grasshopper, go back and wash your rice bowls. Because I knew the yuan was screwed with. I didn't realize we were screwing with, but that's just simple little me.
Well, let's just call it a layered approach to screwing America, shall we?
Or a layered approach to fattening the calf.
Ends up about the same. Yeah.
So, you know, we're going forward with the notion, and that's a drum I'm beating. You know, maybe we, you know, frankly, the Horn does not have the infrastructure to have done every room. But we're going forward on the notion that that's what we're going to keep on talking about doing because it's got to be done. And the Horn will do its part whenever it can and however it can. And to the extent it can.
You know, I wanted to let you know something along those lines. I'm doing everything I can, not at the moment, but it's definitely on my list to spec a completely open source set of software tools to soup to nuts run a small radio station. And I personally would like to have a tool like that. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm working on that in the background. I have nothing to show. It's going to probably be a year at least before I have a good spec.
But you know what? That's brilliant, Grant, because if that's in existence and you can say, you know, this is all open source, then when and if some little bit of money gets scraped together to buy some little radio station in Busted Knuckle, then there will be a tool there that will make it that much less expensive to do what they're doing, which makes it that much more likely that it will be that it will be a sustainable undertaking.
Yeah, cheap to keep bootstrap. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the intention.
Yeah. So for heaven's sakes, keep at it and keep me posted on it.
I will. When I have something of worth to show, I'll share the spec with you. But I'm taking as my model the example that I sent you some emails on some time ago about the gentleman during the Bosnian War.
Right, yes.
Who had to run his rig remote to stay out of harm's way. But he did it.
Yeah.
With off-the-shelf stuff.
And if
I better let you go.
All right. Well, Grant, thank you so much. I really appreciate everything you've offered this evening.
Great. I hope it helps everybody.
It does. It does. This whole process helps. But you know that.
I like this new media we are.
I like that sentence a lot, too. This new media we are.
It's yours. Throw in some rye bread with the toaster.
Will do. Take care.
All right, man.
Have a great weekend, Grant. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I like this new media we are. Yeah. All we have to do is keep it alive. All we have to do is keep it alive. Hey, welcome to the program.
Emery boards, huh?
Emery boards and sunflower seeds.
You know what? I think you just started a new new organization, the MSLU, the Metrosexual Labor Union. Something to keep in mind.
You don't want those cuticles getting out of hand.
Yeah, you got to start small. Well, I called to talk about the. I don't think I've heard you mention him, but I talked to him about a little bit about the story with John Alvin Green.
Oh, dude out of South Carolina?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
But
you know what? It's not a paranoid fantasy to think that he's a Republican plant. I mean, when you've got leading Democratic political leaders in South Carolina saying exactly that, you know, I don't feel quite so crazy anymore.
You know, there's a guy's name. I wanted to bring this is why I wanted to bring, cuz I thought you would care to know about this. There's an operative who has been working some time and may have taken it to another level by going with this primary. His name is Ron Shealy. He studied under the wings of Lee Atwater. He has a record of riding dark horses for victory. And he scored a huge upset when his candidate for the state house, Nathan Ballantyne, knocked off House Majority Leader Richard Quinn Jr. in 2006.
Is this in South Carolina?
Yes. And he also had one of the tricks in 1990 that got him one of the charges where he actually had a black fisherman run for Congress. An unemployed black fisherman to run for Congress in a Republican primary against incumbent Arthur Revnell Jr., even paying Hunt's filing fee. When the ploy was revealed, Sheely was convicted and fined for violating campaign laws. So I've been doing some research on Alvin Green, as you can see.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you something.
It follows the same pattern, it sounds like.
It does. Now, here's the interesting thing. On Free Times, there was a, I don't know if this is a right-wing website or whatever, but I guess, okay, it's Columbia's Free Weekly in South Carolina. Anyways, there was an article talking about how he doesn't have a chance in hell, basically, and this is a phantom candidate for U.S. Senate, and this is from late May, and it talks a little bit about his background, and Bob, I mean, if there was ever a person to look into someone, how they got the money, why they decided to run for office, who put that in their ear, he's never shown any political interest before. I'm sure, have you seen the Olbermann interview?
No.
Jesus, God. When you see the Olbermann interview, you'll be like, oh, my God, there's something going on here. I can't place my finger on it. It's like a deer in the headlights, Bob. He has the other interesting thing that I found that I think people find interesting is when they did his first interview, he wasn't surprised that he won. Now, at least, see, if someone told me, you won, are you surprised? He's like, no. I was like, what? You never had a political, it's insane, Bob. He's never had a political background. You guys can look all you want. You're not going to see one, even though he says he's always been a Democrat. That's nice. You've never had any community service? You're looking suspect, dude. They got a felony charge on him in the wings with being involved with a college student.
Yeah, threatening a co-ed? What?
So here's a question. I actually watched a video of Sheely a little bit, and that guy's a piece of work, and I just kept thinking, And then there's also rumors, a lot of people are mentioning this, but there's also rumors that there were early South Carolina party members on the GOP celebrating on Twitter talking about Alvin Green. So people might want to look into Facebook and stuff and keep looking at where he got the seed money from, because when he was on Olbermann, and I urge you to watch the interview because...
I will. I absolutely will. I'm getting feedback now saying, yeah, that it was absolutely scary.
And the Shep Smith one was scary, too, on Fox News. He asked him point blank. He said, is there someone in the room with you? And he's like, no. He's like, it sounds like there's someone in the room with you. Oh, that's just my dad. Is there anyone else in the room with you? No. Like, what?
Well, I guess a sugar daddy is a form of dad, huh?
Yeah, a sugar daddy is a form of dad. And you know the amazing thing is when they asked him, they've been asking, I heard another interview he did, and they asked him, they said, hey, so did you have a campaign staff? And in one interview he said no. And then the next he said, yeah, a few. It's really, really bad, Bob. It's really, really bad. It doesn't make any sense. It smells to high heaven. And I really hope they look into where he got that money from, because I just don't believe
it. But isn't the damage already done? I mean, there's nobody to challenge in the general. Even if he's thrown off the ballot, there's nobody to challenge in the general.
I know.
So, therefore, mission accomplished, right?
I know. But it would still be interesting to see who put up the money. I just want to know. I'd like to know who put up the money. I like, and if I, they dig deeper into, oh, and then there's the issue of his involuntary discharge, or whatever the hell he was trying to downplay to the media. I mean, they need to look into why he was thrown out of the military.
But that hasn't quite happened yet, has it?
No, that hasn't happened, and that's what a lot of people who are journalists in training need to do, and they need to look into. And for those people listening, you really need to look into Ron Sheely.
Spell it.
S-H-E-A-L-Y. And you can actually see a video where he's sitting. I guess he has a penchant for Hawaiian shirts and cigars. Go figure, huh?
Well, even though it's South Carolina, there are campaign finance filing requirements.
Right, right. Oh, that article that I was talking about where they said a phantom candidate for U.S. Senate, they talk about that when even the Democratic Party chairwoman, Carol Fowler, was a bit surprised how he came into her filing for this, and it didn't make any sense. He lived on a
'cause the filing fee was like 10 grand, right?
Yeah, but you know what his excuse for that was, right?
Can't wait.
He said he saved money because he was a veteran. He had money in the he had money in the cookie jar.
Jesus, criminy. This could be no. I've been reading and just waiting for something to break on this, and so far nothing has.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll send you the link to the Free Time story that was passed to me. I just found that about a day ago, and I've been looking at it right now. And then I'll send you a link to the Harper's for the Ron Sheely story on the GOP consultant operative who trained under Lee Atwater, and that's from Harper's from 2007. I've just been interested in this story for a number of reasons. After I saw the interviews, I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. None of this makes any sense, given this guy press, too.
No, it doesn't. There's not anything about that whole thing that makes any sense. And like I said, the beauty of it is, even if it all gets bounced out on its ear,
right?
It's a pass for the general election.
I hear you completely, and I just wanted to get your take on, because I know you're from the South. What would be needed for something like this to? How would you go about to get someone like this and something to that effect? He lives with his mom. I don't know if people.
I don't know how you begin to find that guy.
But does it make sense that he had $10,000?
No, no, yeah. It doesn't.
Hmm.
David in Tennessee offering his theory. He says, my theory is that the South Carolina Repigs wanted to see more dirt on a Dem than there was on Sanford and so forth. So they plant a total loser, soon to be convicted felon, and start talking about how the Democratic Party's dirty, too.
I can see that. Completely.
It's really the only theory that makes very much sense at all.
You know what you might want to do? You might want to play the Olbermann interview sometime next week or whenever you get a chance so people can hear the craziness of it.
Or just refer them to it. Do you have to recall, what night was it?
If you just type in Olbermann and Alvin Green with an E in the end, you should be able to find it right at the top on YouTube. So type in Alvin Green, Olbermann. It'll come right up.
You know, the other thing that inures to the Repig Lickens' benefit, David,
yeah,
is that in not having, even though nobody was going to necessarily unseat Jim DeMented because he is perfectly situated, you know, he's the perfect South Carolina candidate. Even bearing that in mind, having this guy become the nominee and then get bounced out of the process means Jim DeMint doesn't have to spend any money at all.
Oh.
And he walks back into reelection, which is good for his war chest, which therefore, you know, from the old axiom of follow the money, look into Jim DeMented's office and see who might set that up. Because all the benefit inures to him.
Something to make you ponder, and like I said, if there are any journalists out there who have an investigative itch, find out where that seed money came from.
Yeah, and my money, my money bets that it's not a matter of giving him 10 grand, it's a matter of giving him 20.
And imagine
10 for being the patsy that'll eventually go to some Republican criminal lawyer anyway,
yeah,
and 10 for the filing fee.
Oh, that was the other thing. I want to know who his attorney is too, because on the Oberman, you can hear somebody whispering in his ear through an earpiece. And he said on another interview that that was his attorney.
Interesting indeed. Well, David, thanks. That's a very good topic to maybe keep keep on the radar. And see what shakes out.
Yeah, any updates I see.
Yeah, keep following it because eventually it's going to turn into something interesting. And the beautiful thing out of this is that if it does trail back into DeMint's office, then what was originally a plan to make his reelection a shoe-in could actually be the end of him.
Hmm. That would be good.
Remember, everything that brought down Richard Nixon and resulted in his resignation. All started with a little organization called CREEP, the Committee to Re-Elect the President. It's sort of a corollary to the idea that, they didn't take down Al Capone for murder, they took him down for tax evasion.
Makes a lot of sense to me.
So if at any point in time Jim DeMint's fingerprints wind up on this, he could be talking to a grand jury. Which I would just love to see.
Oh, I would love to see that, too. Well, Bob...
Because he's nuts.
I agree with you. There's a lot of people nuts.
Indeed. David, have a great weekend.
You too, Bob.
See ya. Thanks. Bye now. And speaking of nuts, before I go on to the phones, and they're loaded, you know the teabaggers? The teabaggers, they're... They want their country back, and they want liberty, and they want freedom, and they want the government off their backs. Well, guess what? The latest manifestation of get the government off our backs is just to be surrounded by just to feel the rays of irony the passing through my body. I would dearly love to be in Gwinnett County, Georgia, tomorrow. Because the teabaggers, with their colleagues, Freedom Works, are mounting a new protest on the latest invasion of freedom in Gwinnett County. Because they got a new law that's on the backs of the people in Gwinnett County. It's a law that's going to take away freedom in Gwinnett County. It's a law that's going to chip away at liberty in Gwinnett County. The Four Corners Tea Party, Freedom Works, Gwinnett, and Gwinnett Citizens for Responsible Government have a protest going tomorrow. Begins at 11 a.m. at the gazebo next to the Gwinnett Historic Courthouse on the Lawrenceville Square in Georgia. And they're going to ring it out. They're going to hammer out freedom and hammer out justice. And sing them some protest songs. Amen. And they're going to let the world know that they're not going to stand idly by while their rights and freedoms are trampled by Gwinnett County's new law that requires people to have their garbage picked up. No, really. Do you understand what a struggle it is sometimes on this program for me to get through one of those bits without going... It's our way of letting the commissioners know we remember their vote, and we're not going to forget it. We want to make sure they're held accountable for their vote to make us have our garbage picked up. Those are quotes. Those are real-life teabagging quotes from Gwinnett County, Georgia. The county's new solid waste program makes trash collection mandatory for all homeowners in unincorporated Gwinnett County. City residents are not affected by the plan because they've been having their garbage picked up for years. By God, we got a constitutional right, and it's right there next to life, liberty, and the Pledge of Allegiance in the Constitution.
to just keep piling our garbage up around us and maybe burning it once in a whilst. We of the Four Corners Tea Party, we're concerned with requiring people who live in the unincorporated parts of the county to pay for trash pickup whether they like it or not. And as liberty-loving sons of Gwinnett and daughters of Gwinnett, we don't like having our trash picked up. We like that aroma of garbage juice running around our driveways and gutters and whatnot. We like it. 'Cause if you got garbage, it means you got liberty. You can have my garbage when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers. Thank God for the Georgians standing up for the liberty to keep their garbage. I think I'm going to just have to stand up and spontaneously say the pledge or something. One nation under garbage with liberty and refuse for all. Amen. Praise Jesus. I mean, for God's sakes, if I ain't dumping out the back, how the hell am I going to have any rats to plunk at with my 357 Magnum long barrel? You should see how them rats, and they get pretty near big cats down here in Gwinnett County. You should see, they go splat real big when I hit them with one of them hollow points I'm going to use in the revolution. Yeah. You know, before I just lose it, I'm going back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim.
How are you tonight, buddy?
Well, you know, it ain't the same since the Calliope stopped coming by, but I reckon I'll get along.
Oh, well.
Little ice cream man, white truck, white suit used to come by. I used to do with his Calliope just to go on full blast.
I hear you. I think Calliope was also one of the muses, wasn't she?
She was the muse, in fact, of heroic poetry.
Well, I thought. You know, after listening to your caller, I was just thinking about a couple things, and some people might not agree with me, and I hope they don't disagree too terribly, but Bob, there are two books I keep on my bedside reading table. One is The Art of War, and the other is The Prince.
And you know what? There's not a lot of political questions that can't be answered in one or the other.
Well, in The Art of War, Sun Tzu states very, very, very succinctly that in order to defeat your enemy, you've got to be able to think exactly the way he does. And, you know, when I hear this thing by Will Rogers, it's humorous about the Democratic Party. Oh, I don't belong to any organized party. I'm a Democrat. To me, that's no longer funny. Now,
I don't know that. Well, you know, I guess it was easier for him to say it back then because there was some hope of seeing the real change in the country.
Exactly. But when you have a well-organized, well-disciplined group of people who know how to take orders and who know how to implement them, as opposed to a disorganized mob, who's going to be the winner?
The ones that are a little organized.
And I think that it's a time that, and I've said this before, that Democrats need to take a page from the Republican playbook. I mean, homogeneity and spontaneity and diversity are great. But when you're fighting for your life, I think sometimes you have to sacrifice.
Well, yeah, when it comes time that you yell march, it ain't no good if everybody marches off in every direction, in every separate direction on the compass point.
The whole idea of march is to go in one direction together.
You have to be dressed right and covered down. And you have to know right shoulder from left shoulder arms, and you have to be able to respond to your enemy and repay him with his own coin.
Yeah, I'm being reminded by David in Tennessee that Will Rogers made that joke with FDR already in office. And David said, one smiles easily on the victor's podium.
Exactly. And what your young friend Cassie said as far as her contemporaries thinking the way, you know, thinking of how Sarah Palin is so great and this, that, and the other.
And hot. Don't forget hot. That was the part that just gave me the blind shakes.
Well, I can't even do that because I just had dinner and I don't want to lose it.
And we don't want to hear you lose it either, Jim.
Well, I wouldn't do that to anybody, honestly and truly. But, you know, here's the thing. The parents of these children have been brought up in an educational system in which they have been dumbed down as well. And the lack of instruction in government, in history, that has been degraded over the past 30 or 35 years, we have literally raised or reared a generation of functional illiterates.
And again, just as was the case with the right wings having overtaken media in this country, they understood early on that the effort would be generational. And exactly. so it is that at the same time they were taking over media, they had another wing that was dumbing down each generation a little bit more with every graduating class coming out of the, you know, Millard Fillmore High School.
Exactly. And unfortunately, and I have no great pleasure in making this statement, I don't want anybody to misinterpret what I'm saying. From a standpoint of tactics and strategy, that is to their credit, that they had sense enough to...
Well, and yeah, they sat down and started working all this stuff out. I can't begin to comprehend, Jim, the amount of labor that went into all of this.
Well, they were never going to be treated again the way they were treated back in some of the elections they lost. With Goldwater and the things that happened with Nixon and Watergate.
And yet, by comparison, do you remember Dukakis in the tank?
Surely.
And there are a lot of us who said, you know, let's not make that mistake again. And yet in 2004, bless his heart, there was John Kerry in the sperm suit.
You mean when he was windsurfing or?
No. He was at somewhere at NASA and he had the clean suit on. You know, his face behind the little mask and everything, looking totally ridiculous.
I do.
For a photo op, most of us came to refer to that as a sperm suit.
I do. To tell you the truth, I tried to forget that. And after 2004, I sort of lost interest and withdrew. You know, I said, you know, this is enough for me. And it's taken me a long while to get over that 2000.
And yet with something as simple as that, we could never write down a commandment that says, thou shalt not put thy candidate in stupid photo ops.
Well, that's true. Absolutely. But apparently someone hasn't paid attention to that. And they've given people many opportunities to take wonderful pot shots at that. I mean, Lee Atwater taught his disciples quite well. He certainly did. And, you know, going back to this guy in South Carolina who is under indictment, I think he did get, what, 60% of the vote?
Yeah.
And do you know how much money he has in his campaign chest?
Nil?
$114.
You know, early on people were speculating, well, I think that's because he was the first name on the ballot.
I don't think so. I'll tell you this. As far as tracing the money back to DeMint is concerned, I don't think they're going to be able to do it because you can't trace cash. Nobody in DeMint's camp is going to be stupid enough to put their name on a check or anything that can be traced. I mean, think about it.
Oh, I know. But the thing is that the one hope one has, Jim, is that they will get just a tad too big for their britches and screw up. You know, that's how Watergate happened.
But you see, here's the thing. They learned a lesson with Watergate. And if they have any sense, they're not going to repeat the mistakes of that particular incident.
But the only hope is that pride goeth before a fall.
I don't know, Bob. I think they're too well organized. They're too politically savvy, and they are, to make too many repeats of sad mistakes. I don't foresee that.
Well, Jim, tell me, if you know, the primary system, is it set up in South Carolina? Is it like Alabama where even if you're a Democrat, you can go vote in the Republican primary and vice versa?
No. You have to vote one or the other, I believe.
So it's a closed primary?
I believe so. Now, don't hold me to that because I haven't voted in South Carolina in 20 years. I mean, God only knows. I mean, down there, they seem to change the rules every day.
Well, I did notice that Brad Friedman was reporting earlier over at BradBlog that there were significant electronic voting weirdnesses that took place in South Carolina.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, those have happened all over the country. And how many elections in the past 8 or 12 years?
Oh yeah. And it's still not fixed. So as long as it's not fixed, it is still manipulable.
And of course, who makes those machines and who controls them?
Yeah, that wouldn't be our side.
Exactly. But like I say, you know, it's time to get some organization and some direction and some discipline. And sometimes you have to, well, the French king who said, well, Paris is worth a mass.
Yeah, in other words, you prioritize.
You have to prioritize, and sometimes you have to be very pragmatic at the sacrifice of, unfortunately, ideals and principles. If you wish to win in the long run in order to try to come back and be able to implement principles and ideals. I mean, FDR knew that lesson quite well.
Sure. I mean, that's why Huey Long shoved him to the left.
Precisely.
That's why Huey Long was able to shove him to the left.
Well,
before Huey got all dead.
That's right. But I'm just simply saying that we perhaps could take a lesson from the Republican playbook, and you have to sacrifice certain things in order to gain your terminal objective. And that's about all I have to say, my good friend.
Well, thank you, Jim. I do appreciate the offering.
All right. Well, you take care.
I think I heard Rupert in the background there. Give him our regards.
That was a shady lady.
Oh, was that shady?
I had to put the drops in the shady lady's eyes.
I understood. Well, hope she feels better.
She's doing okay. Well, listen, thank you for your kind remarks. I will convey them to her, and on to your next call.
All right. Take care, Jim.
Out here.
Bye now. And moving along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Preston.
Hey, Preston. What's up?
Oh, just...
I just saw your kind link to the New Belgium Brewery on my Facebook page, and I got to tell you, it is engendering a powerful thirst.
Yeah, that's that wonderful brewery I've been talking about based in Fort Collins, a wonderful town that I lived in for a few years. I went to college there, Colorado State University.
Go Rams.
Yes, indeed. And that city's got some wonderful... progressive people doing good work to make it kind of a transition town, they're calling them, towns that are cutting way back on their fossil fuel use and, you know, making things easier for mass transit users, bikers, walkers, making businesses and offices more efficient in their lighting, using more, solar tubing and that kind of thing. So... And also, New Belgium Brewery, on top of their own, they use solar and wind, and they reuse the hops and the grains that they use, and they kind of let them ferment again, and then they create a biogas. So, and on top of that, they help sponsor a sustainable living fair each year, and they've brought all kinds of activists and authors to speak, you know, all kinds of workshops going on. They had the CEO of Patagonia, kind of an outdoor clothing store, there. He's really in tune to the issues that we face. And, but again, just seeing so many options. Last week, you and I were kind of being sentimental over sails and sail ships and stuff like that. And I happened to come across an article right on that issue from Mother Nature Network. And they talk about how for the first time in decades, there's going to be a modern tanker is going to be partially propelled by this giant 160-square-meter kite to pull this giant cargo freighter. So
it's a step forward.
Well, you know, the kite.
But where, Preston, what will be the trade route plied by said freighter?
Good question.
If it's going to bring more crap from China,
yeah,
it's sort of good in theory, not so much in practice.
You're right. Well, they give a couple examples. They're like, buying local is a great idea when you're talking about products that could be grown or made locally. But what about things you can't get at home, like that hybrid manufactured in Japan or that energy-saving appliance from Denmark? Now, both those things we can and should be making here. But, you know, we're in this system right now, and, you know, at least they can start shipping it over here more cheaply. Yeah, and says chances are it got here through marine shipping, a form of transportation that emits more sulfur dioxide than all the world's cars, trucks, and buses combined, and is responsible for 3% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. But a less polluting, more efficient solution may be on the horizon in the form of wind-propelled cargo vessels. This year, for the first time in decades, a sail-powered cargo ship will cross the ocean using a combination of conventional engines and a gigantic kite. This 160-square-meter kite will tow the MS Beluga Skysails. The kite system can cost as much as a few million dollars, but could save shipping companies up to 50% in fuel costs. This pays for itself in just 3 years. And so it goes.
Right. And how fast does a freighter go anyway?
Not very. I mean, the sail ship that you referred to, what was it, not the Conestoga, but...
No, there was the Flying Cloud and the Cutty Sark and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're comparable in speed.
Well, those things were practically racing ships.
Okay.
I mean, they set incredible records. And in fact, I don't even know if fossil fuel powered ships can make the kind of time that they used to make in the Trans-Pacific run from San Francisco to Hong Kong and so forth.
Yeah, they're very dangerous. Those huge tankers too, they sink pretty regularly. But I'm sure there's some business person on some end that cashes in, you know, some insurance policy or whatever.
Sure, just like I found out, much to my chagrin, while over the last weekend and getting ready to go to D.C. that what was it? The Deepwater Horizon rig was insured for twice its fair market value.
Okay. Yeah.
So even when they lose, they win.
Yep.
I mean, that's got to be a tidy chunk of change.
Yes, indeed.
And if I'm not mistaken, it was insured with AIG too, which means, in essence, that we wrote the check on that.
Okay. Cassie brought up several interesting points. I wanted to touch on a couple of things. She was wondering, you know, how does our message get out there, and why isn't it getting it out further? And it is frustrating. And how is it that Glenn Beck and people like that are taken seriously? all good questions.
And when she asks questions like that, and when others ask questions like that, Preston, I am always at pains not to appear to be either glib or sarcastic. And I hope I didn't come across that way, because that was not my goal. And maybe my answers are too facile to be by half, but it certainly feels like reality coming from where I stand.
Yeah, and you know it's hard. You know, it's such a complicated subject. We have to kind of use a shorthand to begin to discuss it. So you know they're going to be facile in a way, but no, I think you covered it well, and she had her own very good ideas and suggestions around it. A book that really I thought was really powerful, an audiobook I listened to, was Al Gore's book, The Assault on Reason. And he touches on a lot of different aspects of this, of the propaganda system we have.
And see, that's what drives me crazy, is you've got somebody like Al Gore out there, Preston, who clearly gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, and I don't mean this to sound bitter, because it's not like I'm calling every day or anything. The odds of somebody like me, who spends a lot of time thinking about these media issues and can actually deliver them the message about, you know, why we've got to do it, I couldn't get a meeting with Al in a million years.
That's a shame.
It's not like I want to sit down and play cribbage with him.
Yeah, I mean, you are natural allies. And there should be partnering and collaboration, you know, although in his defense, I'm sure he's inundated.
Everybody and his cousin want it, sure. Yeah. But, you know, but when that book came out, just so you'll know, and just so folks will know, we've talked about it a little bit, you really went the extra mile to get me a conversation on air with Sandra Steingraber, author of Living Downstream, and we will have her on the show on June the 15th. And it's all Preston's doing, everybody. But I say that, Preston, by way of noting, you see a little bit of what it's like just trying to get one of those set up.
Yeah, and it was also her wonderful publicist, Lisa Warren, who actually wrote a book on book publicity and has a couple posts on the Huffington Post. So I got there's a lot of great support going on there. But it was my pleasure to make the effort, and I'm so looking forward to
I'm just
that.
I am, too, and I am voraciously reading the book. I can't put it down. I was within 15 minutes of being late for the program because I literally couldn't put it down. Having done that, you get an idea of the frustration I went through. I wanted a review copy of Mr. Gore's book, and I wanted Mr. Gore on the program.
Mm. Well, that he missed.
Forget it.
His people missed an opportunity there, for sure. That's too bad.
And that's not me being bitter. You know, I want because we've got it.
Bummer.
It's a matter of people learning to talk about why the message is important. And I don't see my role as an educator, but rather a facilitator of the transmission of information.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't even get the initiators of the information to transmit it, well, that's the other foot going in the bucket, and we're still going uphill.
Yep. So, again, I think that speaks to Cassie's questions. You know, there are things that we're not doing well that we could be doing better. And then there are other sides of it where our efforts are getting thwarted, and there's the financial disparity. I mean, the people behind Glenn Beck, you know, we're talking oil industry and the military, weapons profiteers, endless funds to just spread that stuff all over the place. They study the human psyche, so they know how to not just misinform people politically, but also to manipulate them emotionally as well. So again, back to the Gore book, he cover some of those topics of the psychology of the perception management efforts from the PR firms, and the history of it going back to Edward Bernays, who was actually Sigmund Freud's nephew.
Yes.
Edward Bernays, and he did public relations stuff, publicity stuff for the cigarette industry, was able to get a lot of people hooked on that incredibly unhealthy product, and also did publicity and marketing stuff for the government, like United Fruit when they were in, I think, Honduras. You know, the U.S. wanted to go there and, you know, colonize, take resources and stuff. And so he was involved with doing some of that, you know, preparing the public mind for accepting our naked aggression, just as, you know, we did in Iraq and our naked aggression in Afghanistan. Some of the same sorts of techniques are being used. So the assault on reason and, you know, who knows, maybe we may yet get Gore talking to you. You're going to have a lot of review bugs coming your way.
Well, I hope so. I hope
you're
so.
Have fun with this, man, for sure. And before I let you go, I want to hear your other callers. I know you've got people on the line. I want to say something quickly about the Afghani people and some of their traditions and their culture and stuff. And certainly they've got...
Yeah, I wasn't gooning on them with the pumpkin business. I just was pointing out because I am such a pro-Western Hemisphere geek. And by that, I mean I have such reverence for everything that was done by the native peoples before they were done in by us.
Mm-hmm.
That I sit in restaurants when I have to travel, and for some reason or another, and I think a lot of it has to do with Michael Pollan's work, frankly.
Yeah.
I look at what's on my plate, and I go, damn, what did we eat before we ripped off the Indians? You know, everybody, we think of Italian food, and we can't conceive of Italian food without tomatoes. Well, that's 300 years old, because white Europe was quite convinced that the Indians were secretly trying to poison them with those deadly nightshade berries. No kidding.
Huh.
Jefferson was the first man to actively cultivate the first white guy to actively cultivate tomatoes in his garden, because he had figured out that they weren't poison. It was okay to eat them.
Interesting.
And that's 17 when?
Yeah.
And so, gnocchi that are little potato dumplings. Sorry, you don't get those without the Peruvians or Germans and their potatoes. Yeah. What in God's name was the rest of the world, Indians and the Thais and all of those delightful, I mean, now granted, you know, they had a world of spices, you know, cardamom and black pepper and all those precious, precious goods that were so revered in Europe. But what did they do to make those curries catch fire before they had the chili pepper that was cultivated and developed in Mesoamerica?
Yeah. I wonder. Yeah, there's some interesting books about food histories and stuff coming out. You know, that's where I think Bourdain and Andrew Zimmern have done such important work.
Tony Bourdain has a new book coming out.
Medium Raw, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those are some hoops I'm more than willing to jump through. I got to get him back on the show. I'm such a terrible little fanboy.
Real quickly, though, every now and again, as bad as the corporate media can be, there are people within it. It's not a monolith, and there are people within it who do some good work.